The Academy Opus Cassius is the cheese industry's unique center for professional development, offering both practical and classroom training in the heart of France. For more information, visit academy-mons.com. That's academy-mons.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation, and every Wednesday at 11 a.m. we have a conversation that I hope you enjoy about food, but at a high level, not just food to nourish ourselves, which is obviously a big part of food, but food that nourishes our lives. And today, we're taking the show on the road. We're very excited to be in Paris, who wouldn't be, sitting in the 11th arrondissement at the Auberge Flora, with a chef, I think, who has been in the news a lot lately because he's a young American cook who is operating one of the most desirable and successful restaurants in Paris. Successful in that everyone who's listening here probably wants to come already. Welcome to the show, Daniel Rose. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. This is quite a neat opportunity.
So we're sitting in a noisy cafe. You'll hear clanking of Grand Café Crèmes and all sorts of stuff going on. But we've been already talking about a fascinating conversation. I'm sorry I didn't turn the recorder on earlier. About what it's like. Describe Spring, your restaurant here in Paris, just right now in this moment, where you think it is in its life and what you're doing today.
I think Spring always was my own version of what I thought French cooking was supposed to be, old-fashioned French cooking was. And I think today what's happening is we started out as this sort of young upstart. I started out as a sort of young upstart restaurant with myself in the kitchen. It was very intimate and people really liked this intimacy. And now we have a little bit larger space where it's less intimate, although compared to a lot of other restaurants, it still seems quite intimate.
How many seats is it?
We have 40 seats. 40 seats today, which is funny because it's like people say from New York, they say, "Oh my God, that's really teeny tiny," and I think, "Oh my God, it's huge!"
Right? Wow, 40 seats. Where will we sit? On two floors, though.
Two floors, yeah. Would you remind me never to open a restaurant with two floors again? Everyone told me that before I opened, but I thought, no, if anyone can do it, I can, and they were absolutely right.
And so there's a set menu. You don't order.
What we do is we make dinner or lunch for you. So we have I don't know if it's like a formula, but we think dinner is in three salty courses and dessert and lunch and two and dessert. And we try to construct a dinner that we think will be satisfying. So it's a little bit of everything from all around France with an attention towards, I mean, I don't even want to say because it's sort of cliche, but of course we spend a lot of time trying to find the best product, but that's just normal, everyday part of operating a restaurant, at least in Paris. And then the advantage of being in Paris is that you really have to keep the things come in the back door. Well, they come from the field or from the sea. They're very beautiful, and that's our job to kind of not screw them up until they get to the plate.
so to present the food, to do as little. No, well, it's not about doing as little to it.
It's about preserving the. It's not about, because there are restaurants in Paris that try to do very little to the food, but I think it's about taking these great products and using some of the techniques and some of the. I don't know what the word would be, but using some of the techniques and maybe the point of view of French history, of French cooking, and making sure that, you know, when you blanch asparagus, for instance, for just 10 seconds, beautiful asparagus for 10 seconds, they come out looking more beautiful than they did. They're brighter green, they're crunchier, they're slightly sweeter, even though you've obviously blanched them in salt water and stuff. So we use those little I don't know what the word is, tics of French technique to make things seem, to make things taste as good as they can. So we, our mission is to make asparagus taste like asparagus and veal to taste like veal, and then to accommodate them in a way that, I don't know, sometimes it's interesting. It's never, I would say from my perspective, it's not provocative in any way. It seems very classic. But really it's this notion of satisfaction when you eat something and it's like, yum.
Yum. Well, having eaten there last night, actually, I would agree. It is both cooking from a French point of view and also deeply satisfying. And I think you you should explain a little bit that you came to that point of view, perhaps not the normal route. You did not come to Paris as an American chef hoping to open a restaurant. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that story?
Yeah, it's interesting. This, all the stuff came about. I went through all the periods of... I mean, I moved to Paris because I actually had never been to Europe. And on the 20th of August, 1998, I landed in Paris and had enrolled in the American University of Paris to finish my degree. I thought it would be the easiest degree possible because everyone else's second language was English and mine was that was my first language. So I thought, great, I'll have a leg up.
Because you can speak the language of English in France.
And I arrived and I discovered eating in French I remember the first meal I had, the first serious meal I had was in October, so a few months later, it was a date, and so I remember particularly well, but pigeon and, well, beignet of langoustine with fried parsley, and then pigeon, and there was a finger bowl with a piece of lemon in it, and I almost drank it, and not only did I find the food delicious, but the way in which the woman kept me from drinking the finger bowl water was extremely elegant, and I thought, there's something to this, that this restaurant thing is interesting. This is deeply, there are things going on here that need to be, that I enjoy. And then it's like, you know, when you're a kid and you take apart the telephone and you try to put it back together, you want to understand, like, what the role of a restaurant is, a restaurant in some way is a very superficial thing. At the same it's that equilibrium between the sacred and the profane, you know, the very sacred and the very superficial that all come together in a restaurant. And so something about it excited my curiosity.
And do you think the way those things come together here in Paris or in France is unique in some way? I mean, obviously the restaurants in France hold a certain unique place in the world of gastronomy, but you were from Chicago, which is a town that has some food, perhaps more now than it did when you were there. But what do you think resonated with you differently here about your experiences having eaten in America, let's say?
I think that it's just that here there's a different rhythm, really. So there's the place for these things to happen, and there's a kind of a satisfaction in having a restaurant where those things can happen, and it takes a certain... you can't do that when you're trying to pack in another 4 or 2 or 8. You have to kind of... Sometimes you have to say, oh, let's just do 10 covers tonight and see where it goes, and it's a much different, I don't want to say it's completely commercial relationship, because I think it can happen in other circumstances. I just think the soil here in some way is more fertile for that to happen.
And there's definitely a trend of chefs trying to make that happen at home, but the economic model, I think, gets in the way sometimes. The real estate in New York and how you can have... I mean, your original restaurant had 12 seats?
16 seats. The rent was... I'll give you the details. It was 16 seats. It was... the menu was 36 euros per person. And it was the same number of courses that we serve now. I mean, the dessert maybe was slightly less elaborate, and we didn't serve the little fried oysters in the beginning, and it was a little simpler, but it was 16 seats. The rent was 600 euros a month. I paid a right to have to lease the space. I don't know what you call it in English, but I bought the Fonds de Commerce for 60,000 euros, and I invested another 70 in... you know, all the stuff that you need to have a restaurant. And so it was 140,000 euros from start to finish, and 600 euros a month, and I was the only employee, and it was very...
So you were the only person in the kitchen.
Yeah. For about a year, and then I was the only person in the kitchen. And when the first reviews came out, I was the only person in the restaurant. And then a couple weeks after we opened, there was a lovely woman that lived upstairs, who's on her way to being a well-known fashion designer in Montreal. Elisa, who came down and stuck her head in with her helmet on and said, "Oh, I've worked at a creperie or something. If you ever need any help, I'd be glad to help you." I think I paid her 400 euros a month to help me. And in fact, what happened was, when I first opened the restaurant, I thought it was 8 tables of 2, and then I thought, well, 4 tables of 4 is easier to manage. And I would write on the outside of the restaurant just the products that we had. And I remember there's a photo that I have that says lamb and octopus and all this kind of stuff, and I would construct a meal for each table. And kind of more or less spontaneously, although I had some preconceived ideas about what I was going to make. And then one day, I was doing that for a couple weeks, and I was driving myself crazy in an exciting way. And she said, "You know, everyone wants to come to this restaurant. I think you should just serve all 16 people at the same time." And then she said, "Yeah, I'll just take reservations. Everyone comes at 8:30. In fact, I don't even think she told me. She just did it. And she's like, "Oh, it looks like you have to cook for everyone at the same time." And that was the real... There were unexpected benefits to that system. One was for the people coming, I think they really felt people would wait until the table next to them was served before they would start eating. And I would make 16 of each thing, or 15 if there was a table of 3, 15 of each thing, and I'd just make it and then take it all away. And then while they were eating, I would be working on the next one, and then I would do that. And it was interesting. Sometimes anything that was... I never gave myself the opportunity to work on anything other than an immediate sort of instinct. Mm. So there was no repetitive mise en place. There was nothing. And sometimes it was very thrilling, and sometimes it was less good. I mean, but people... And that's when I learned too, that when, you know... And this still happens, and I think a lot of cooks out there will say it, will understand what I'm saying, but sometimes you make something that you think is really great, and people are like, "Oh, I'm pretty good." And sometimes you make stuff, and you're like, "Oh, my God, that was inedible." And people are like, "That was the best fish I've ever had." And you're like, "Okay, I don't understand." And then you still don't understand all these years later.
So it's almost sounds like you created your own training ground in some way. You were put to the test every day in your own kind of pop-up, although you had a permanent place and a permanent time. But you were just cooking, you know, being thrown the basket of ingredients which you selected and go.
Yeah, although the difference was that I gave myself way more than a minute 30, which is what you get on Top Chef or something like that. I gave myself all day, and in some days I gave myself 3 days where I would really go to the market very early, and then... I was at the market at 7 in the morning, and I was cooking for 16 people. So if you have 16, you know, whatever, you take 16 of the same size potatoes, and you take 16 langoustines, and you pick each one out one by one. It's interesting. Unfortunately, some of those habits I kept when we opened a restaurant that had more seats, and it's not compatible with... serving more than, or at least I'm not capable of doing that for 25 people at a time.
Okay, well, so let's talk about that next phase two. Okay, so you moved. What moved you to move, for starters, and what's the difference now?
I had a gentleman that I know has become quite a good friend, and he follows me in all these adventures, who came and I did cooking classes sometimes on Saturday mornings, and we did a cooking class. There were 4 guys in the class. I would just do the same thing I would do. I would construct the spring menu with people and go through the thought process of how we would do it, and then we'd drink a lot of wine at the same time. So I think we made something like 10 or 12 different preparations and ate them at the same time, and there was like 9 or 10. At the time I was on this, I had a neighbor who had all these bottles of wine from Alsace that were really exceptional, and I was drinking wines, beautiful Rieslings that were 20 years old and stuff. I mean, it was quite a crazy day, but we drank 9 or 10 or 12 bottles of wine. And then at the end, he's like, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I have no idea." And he said, "Why don't you look at opening a larger restaurant?" And so a buddy of his knew somebody who identified this space in the first. That was a former skateboard shop that had been closed for a while. And I walked in and I felt like, wow, I could do something here. Let's do something. At the time, I had a waitress who was a sommelier, who's gone on to open Au Passage and is also associated with the Bones restaurant here in Paris, named Audrey Jarry. She was the first real sommelier that I had. She taught me a lot of things. And I had another cook with me in the kitchen, a woman named Marie-Aude Mary, who became my wife. And I looked at them, I said, this was before there was anything more than a professional relationship. I said, let's open a new restaurant. Will you guys come along? They said, yeah. And I put down 1 month's rent on the place, and I had, you know, sleepless nights of sweating and nightmares about how I was going to pay 10 times the rent and all this stuff. But I thought, let's go. And so that began a two-year process, unfortunately, of renovating the space and trying to figure out what the next evolution would be. And I think it became a restaurant that more fully developed what we started at the first one. I think the real key to the second restaurant was that there was a place for service that there wasn't in the first. I mean, I distinctly remember a moment in the first restaurant where somebody asked me for a cup of coffee and I couldn't make it. I was answering the telephone and doing the crème citron at the same time, and I was like, this is dumb. This is a dumb restaurant. Like, I don't want to be at this restaurant anymore. There was a time where I was willing to pay 36 euros for a meal and be excited about it, but now I don't care. I want to pay 150 and I want them to call me a taxi when it's done.
Right.
Well,
so I have to ask this because it just seems so obvious. What are the challenges of being an American doing this in Paris? Are there challenges, or am I projecting that it would be hard to sort of gain traction, or was there something unique about the small ambition you began with that made it more plausible?
I think it's several things. I mean, one, I don't know because I didn't try to do this somewhere else. So from my perspective, it's very difficult to know exactly. I think that what was very appealing to the French in the beginning. I mean, Manuel Rubin from the Figaro wrote something after 2 weeks of being open that I think is probably one of the most touching things that's ever been said about my restaurant. He said, c'est un restaurant qui ressemble à la vie. It's a restaurant that resembles life. And I thought, I mean, I get the little, I think, wow, that's interesting. And I think that what people felt that discovered it was this for the French, it was this sort of courageous, ambitious but unthreatening act of doing this thing that nobody else was doing. I mean, everybody I spoke to be very pessimistic about the world and, oh, it's going to be too much work and, oh, you'll never make any money and, oh, it's, you know, nothing but trouble and you're going to work 20 hours a day. They were all right.
Right.
But it was thrilling and it was fun.
Right.
And it still is.
Right.
So I think they got excited about that, and then I think they got excited that there was I was trying to understand what it was about. Look, what's famous in French cooking? Maxime's was, you know, Rue Royale, and even, you know, Paul Bocuse. And today people go to Paul Bocuse and they're like, oh, I don't really understand. There was a period in the world where French cuisine was, there was nothing more delicious in the world. And there was a reason why. I think, and when you go to Paul Bocuse and eat a pot de crème, which now everyone in the world puts on every brasserie menu everywhere, crème caramel, or crème brûlée or whatever, there's a way to make it transcendent. I don't like to use that word, but really supremely delicious. And I think I was trying to discover what it was about French cooking that made it so famous, what makes it so delicious. And then I realized it wasn't just about food, it was about the French restaurant. The restaurant makes things delicious, not just the food. It was exciting to the French. They were really thrilled that somebody was doing that in Paris, was an American, and was not doing it from the perspective of, well, I'm going to come and conquer Paris with my restaurants. Well, it wasn't really the idea at all. It was a gentle appreciation of things that French people love, and they.
And maybe have forgotten a little bit even in some ways, like, yeah. Because cuisine restaurants here for a long time, from my perspective, were not pleasant or delicious or even welcoming.
Yeah, and I think that was when Spring opened in 2006. This was a real moment in in where you could go back to the essential of the French restaurant. I don't think we reinvented anything. I learned to do this from people that did it very well, and for whatever reason, I wouldn't say got off track, but there was other priorities, and we returned to the essential part about receiving people and cooking for them. And little by little, we're sort of reconstructing, and little by little, it resembles a classic French restaurant in some way.
On that thought, we're going to take a brief break. I'm talking with Daniel Rose in Paris, the chef and owner of Spring Restaurant. Remember that you can, if you're listening to the podcast, you can write us at info@heritageradionetwork.org, or you can tweet us questions or comments or things we can get to Daniel at Taste Matters HRN. Thanks. We'll be right back.
This is an original song from Matt Stewart on heritageradionetwork.org.
The Academy Opus Cassius is the cheese industry's unique center for professional development, offering both practical and classroom training for cheese professionals ready to move their careers to the next level. When you come to learn at the Academy, we instill our love for cheese, our expertise, and our experience so that you can support artisanal producers, impeccably care for the fine cheeses you carry, and serve your customers with skill and enthusiasm. We integrate hands-on practice, formal instruction, and classroom discussion in all of our courses. The Academy's programs are offered at the Mons Fromagerie in the heart of France, where cheese undergoes affinage and cheeses are received, prepared, and shipped. Several Mons retail shops are nearby. The surrounding countryside is the home to producers whose excellent cheeses are cared for by the Mons team. The Mons cheese business has more than 50 years' experience caring for and teaching about cheese in France, a country known as the source of some of the world's greatest cheeses, deepest cheese tradition, and the highest level of technological research and rigor in cheese making and ripening. The Academy has been recognized by the American Cheese Society as the first approved education center for those preparing for the Certified Cheese Professional exam. Enroll now for Essential Foundations for Cheese Professionals or Affinage, the Art and Science of Maturing Cheese. For more information, visit www.academy-mons.com. That's academy-mons.com. Certified Cheese Professional is a registered trademark of the American Cheese Society.
So welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm with Daniel Rose, chef of Spring in Paris. And since we are in Paris and it's Sunday and the market on the Rocher Le Noir is up and running, we thought we'd walk through together and talk a little bit about what's here. And oh my God, we're standing in front of an incredible fish purveyor. But what did you just say about why you come to the market? Because obviously you can't shop here for the restaurant every day.
Yeah, the market is a barometer for the produce that's coming out. But in France too, it's not just the produce that changes season, but the fish and the meat even is seasonal. So you go to the market to sort of, well, you're getting in touch with two things. You're getting in touch with the products themselves, but also with the people shopping who are eventually your customers. So you know that when you see people buying these beautiful cherries at the market, that you're going to have to do a lot better
than they're going to do with the cherries.
So you have to be very careful. You know? Right.
I once ran into Dan Barber from Blue Hill at the Union Square Market, and he said, we were talking over the tomato selection. He said, you should come in sometime, and I'll make you a tomato salad. And I said, Dan, I know where you get your tomatoes. I'm going to have the same salad.
Yeah, it changes the way in which you cook, because you know your customers at home. I mean, my customers in Paris, they eat very well. They buy delicious food and they make it very simply for themselves. So you have to adjust your. You have to be careful about what you're going to propose to them in some way.
I think that's so interesting. And in fact, probably quite different from the customer base in general in American restaurants, which may be less familiar with some of the things that are being presented to them.
Maybe in the States it's less likely that they're going to have access to the same products. And now what I have to do is I look at this and I think, okay, good. My tortos are nicer than the ones that
yeah, they're selling at the market. Great.
That's reassuring also. They're also more expensive, so I'm glad to know that there's still a link between... In France, there's definitely a link that's respected between the price of a product and the quality. And that, in this, I don't know, because I never buy food in the States. My mom does the grocery shopping and all that stuff. But I feel like here, there's a real, it's preserved in a more exclusive way. And also, sometimes it's not even the price, it's just when you know the person for long enough, they take those two lobsters that are a little nicer than the other one.
You said something earlier about the scale of a restaurant and how being a little bit bigger allows you to do things perhaps a little better and also to get the better torto or to whatever. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, I mean, if you're buying piece by piece, you, like when I did at the other restaurant, I didn't have access to the best pigeons, for example, because they don't sell them by 8 pieces at a time. And I couldn't buy 50 pieces at a time, but 60 pieces is too many. And so now what we do is we find the best stuff and we just buy the whole lot. And then when it's done, it's done.
Right.
Yeah, that's one of the advantages of not having a menu either, is that. But like now, I see the crabs there with the huge pinchers. Yeah, that's. I want one of those for lunch. That one right there is enough. You could make one lunch like that would be delicious.
So let's go. Let's walk over. Pardon. It's pretty busy and pretty tight here. I've never seen a crab like that in my life, honestly.
Du marché.
Ouais, voilà.
Alors là, vous allez être gâtés là.
Je parlais justement de vos pinces de torto qui.
Le torto, le gros
oui.
Torto.
Ah, ils sont jolis.
C'est magnifique.
Je dois me présenter, mon père Daniel. Rose, j'ai un restaurant dans les premiers.
Ah, vous avez un restaurant.
Ouais. Je fais rarement de marché parce qu'on est coincé dans notre cuisine et tout, mais ça.
Oui. Alors là, vous allez vous régaler parce que j'ai des beaux turbos des Sables d'Olonne. J'ai du bar de ligne qui est magnifique.
We have been spotted because of our apparatus here, and so the poissonnier, the fishmonger, is pointing out some of the things he thinks are beautiful, including these gigantic crabs that they're just huge living creatures. They look amazing.
And live langoustines, this is very rare.
Live langoustines, large, almost like baby lobsters, like chick lobsters, and beautiful scallops with the roe in the shells.
Dans le premier, rue Bayeul.
Rue Bayeul.
Louvre Rivoli.
Rue de Rivoli.
Oui.
Ça s'appelle comment?
Spring.
Spring.
Comme le printemps.
Ok. C'est bon à savoir. On ira vous voir.
C'est un bon restaurant aussi.
Il n'y a pas de problème.
Merci. Merci de partager votre travail.
So in many cultures, the whole market phenomenon is diminishing.
This is nice. Sometimes the market is not the best place to find stuff, but actually what I'm seeing here is, I mean, this makes cooking so easy. I go find that torto, I can buy. I mean, now I can't, but because they're too big. But when you have a restaurant with 16 seats, you buy 8 of them. And then you create, there's one plate. You only have to make 3 per day, 3 plates, so there's one course. The turbo looks excellent. There's course number 2. There's a chapon, which is very rare.
What is it? I don't even. Chapon doesn't look familiar to me.
I don't know what it is in English, but it's like a.
Let's go take a look.
Rustic red snapper.
Oh, yeah. Looks a little bit like a rascasse, but not as scary.
Yeah. It's nice. Oh. The Pajot, see, it's like a big dorade.
Beautiful.
From Britain.
Okay, so that was Lorenzo, Poissonnerie Lorenzo, which looks to be very special, beautiful product here on the side of the street. No video, just radio.
People still have radios, believe it or not.
What is a radio? I have no idea.
It's actually on the internet now.
This is joli, huh?
Beautiful.
Yeah, very nice. That's nice.
Cheesemongers, beautiful pile of spring onions. I've seen more kinds of spring onions than I've ever could have imagined here since we got here a week ago.
Yeah, there's new, there's different trends that happen, but there's now these new onions called the Trebons, Trebons, from southwest of France that are very sweet, and they only happen for a couple months out of the year. They're very delicious. But, you know, the good thing is that here you have the the nave, the turnips are delicious. So we don't have to seek out interesting or new products. We just keep using the same ones that have always been delicious. So same thing with the herbs. I mean, there's sometimes trends where, oh, we put these microgreens or stuff like that. I'm still discovering the fines herbes and why, you know, ciboulette and mint, and mint is technically one of the fines herbes, but parsley and tarragon. And I feel like tarragon is uncharted territory still. I mean, excellent tarragon is fascinating. It's slightly anise, slightly anise flavored. It can also be a little bit minty. It can be, when it's very fresh, it can be slightly acidulated. So I think it's sometimes more interesting to go back to the classic and figure out why it's delicious than to get the latest micro cress thing, or the, now the tendency is to find herbs that nobody really wants to eat that grow on the side of the road.
Sorry to all of you Nordic chefs listening.
Some of them are delicious, but they really take a very careful consideration of how to serve them and why to serve them, other than for their novelty. So,
well, I do. I mean, I've just met you, and I've enjoyed getting to know you through our conversation, and it strikes me as though your enthusiasm of rediscovery of these things must be part of what makes your experience here so unique in the restaurant, because you are excited to discover these things that perhaps French people or people all over have forgotten in some ways, especially in this trend to constantly new, to innovative, post-molecular gastronomy, whatever the things are that you're thinking. Your eyes just light up when you talked about a tarragon in a way that I think is really refreshing.
Well, I think it's that's the privilege of being in France. But it's in the image of, we created a restaurant in Paris, and Paris is a city. Maybe we created a restaurant in the image of Paris also, which is something that's sort of slightly avant-garde but never changes. And there's this notion of entrenched classic reassurance in some way that we try to preserve through it's here. You can't avoid it. It would be very strange to take that asparagus and to mix it up into a puree and put it into a thing that mousses it up. Right. It doesn't make any sense. It's better if you just cook it and put some salt on it.
Yes.
Or not.
Right. Fascinating. And speaking of asparagus, we're walking by these gigantic white asparagus standing at attention. Kind of amazing to see.
Cucumbers, for example. I read in an old cookbook, one of my favorites from 1973. It's not that old, but it's The Secrets of Michelin-Starred Restaurants. And there's a restaurant, somewhere outside of Paris where nobody goes anymore. It's pigeon with sautéed cucumbers. And I thought, that sounds really delicious. Young pigeons from the springtime with young cucumbers. And I mean, the idea sounds, when I serve it, people say, oh, that's so inventive. And I think, actually, it's traditional pigeon with cucumbers.
At the same time of the year.
Cucumbers, yeah, but when they're dense and they're not full of water, it's almost like a zucchini or something. So.
Amazing. Last night you roasted a radish, I believe, in one of our dishes. Yum. That also reminds you.
I literally only had four of the radishes, the big white radishes. They were sweet and slightly, I don't know, something very satisfying in them. You have bitterness too, which is not something that you necessarily want to avoid. But I don't know. I'm very lucky. Now that I rarely get out of the restaurant when I see this thing. I'm very, very lucky.
I would agree with you, and I would think that everyone listening, every chef listening at home, would agree with you that you are indeed very lucky to be doing what you're doing in a beautiful setting in Paris here amongst all this incredible stuff. You are now excited about a beautiful potato. Wow, a potato that smells like dirt and potatoes all at the
yummy,
same
time. Yeah.
For the season. It's been an unusual season here, I understand. It's cold and rainy at the end of May in Paris and has been pretty chilly all throughout France. We were just in the southwest where it was practically freezing every night. Everyone was aghast at the weather.
Yeah. That's also one of the good things about having a menu that changes all the time, is that, I mean, this is soup week. We have to start the menu with something sweet, something hot, and last night it was something slightly spicy too, because there's this need for me, it's better, I prefer cooking when it's cooler, because you can, the satisfying, you know, alchemy of cook things. You can still... It's harder to do that in the summer.
It's like dressing, too. You can wear clothes
in
the fall, and you can eat
food. You're excited to go back and put a sweater on. Exactly. In the summer, you put on your flip-flops and a bathing suit, which is exactly what you need, but we don't always look so good in them.
And maybe we'll leave you with that image, since we're well over time. Daniel Rose in his flip-flops and his bathing suit. Surrounded here by people and so fascinated by what's around them, so fortunate to be looking at all of these incredible produce of France. For anyone who thinks that the food in France is over, I mean, that's such a funny thing to think about. But perhaps people like Daniel Rose are reminding the French of the incredible things that they have, and certainly bringing the attention of the rest of the world back to Paris, where for many, many reasons it belongs when you're talking about the world of gastronomy and restaurants. So thank you for joining us. It's been a real pleasure to get to know you and to chat with you here in your adopted homeland.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Now I'm starving.
You're starving me too. The smell of cheese is a little overwhelming. Thank you for listening. This is Taste Matters on Heritage Radio Network. You can find our podcasts on iTunes, or you can communicate with us through Twitter at Taste Matters HRM. In the meantime, why don't you try to make plans, but for next week, why don't you try to make plans to get back to Paris and to enjoy the bounty of food and cuisine and the incredible assortment of restaurants that they're so fortunate to have here. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.